Our third and final speaker in this session is Dorothy Boris from Georgia College, speaking on communicating climate science and climate justice to faith communities.
Thank you, and hello, everybody. It was a wonderful setup, almost like volleyball set to spike, you know, so hopefully we'll be able to do a good job here with that. But I'm from Georgia College, where I'm an aquatic ecologist, and I spend a lot of my time talking about climate science and churches because that's the issue I went into after my area of expertise, which is small wetlands that dry, were so affected by climate change. So before we say very much more, I will tell you that I am the author, the lead author on Loving the Least of These, Addressing a Changing Environment, published by the National Association of Evangelicals, which it just a year ago published the second edition. So in 2011, when the first edition came out, we had to be very careful in a lot of our communication. We focused on some things that you might not think about when publishing for a broad evangelical audience. We counted the number of times that we said climate change, and any other way we could possibly say it, we did. We never used the term global warming, which was an anathema at the time. And we looked for the original peer-reviewed research for any claim we made that you would normally have just gone to an IPCC report because of a general distrust of Europeans, apparently. Now, that's speaking as an American, we've been on a roller coaster ride, all of you know that, in this, but we did do some things that I think worked very well. One was we always started with the Bible, we then talked about the theological basis for caring for creation, and made that link to poverty, trying to promote an individual face to poverty. We had to do a dance between calling on people's emotions, in which that is how every communication expert says you get people to change what they do. But scientists, you know, every claim you make has to be backable, and you have to say where that backing comes from. So you don't want to be accused of being emotionally manipulative, and because of that, we are we're constantly dealing with that, but we tried to walk that. We talked a little bit about climate science, and then specifically the overlap of climate and poverty, and then something on solutions. Now leap ahead to 2022, and we were freer. Climate change has been more talked about, and the voice of young people has come to the fore. The young evangelicals for climate action had been formed. They were getting some press. And so the second edition is less about persuasion that this is a real problem and Christians should pay attention to it, and more about how is it playing out and what is happening in our world and what might we do. But if you can imagine the solutions, there's this thing called solution aversion when people don't want to acknowledge that the problem is real because they've already leapt ahead to what they think the solutions are going to require and they don't want it. And that is backwards from a thinking perspective. So we focused on the fact that wherever you were on the political spectrum, there were things that you could do. There were solutions that you could buy into. Okay, we still have to be very careful about the different solutions. But that has been a powerful tool. So I just give that because I think that we've talked quite a bit about some of the changes in the last 11 years, and the fact that there's this huge generational change. So this came out in the spring. Let's just check in with one room and see now the Yale Program for Climate Change Communication. It's a great place to look up some of this stuff. George Mason University Center for Climate Change Communication. And they put out this report. So this is up to 22. And no shock to anybody, but there is a huge division in politics about climate change. And that is much, continues to be a very strong division. However, we have a majority of people that, of U.S. adults, say that climate change is a major threat to the country. And when Americans are polled about what they think, scientists think, this is an improvement. It used to be that when polled, people would say they didn't think that scientists were in agreement on anything. And now you can see that that is going up. However, there's a small but persistent percent that say most scientists think global warming isn't happening. I don't know how you could come to that thought, but oh well. So let's ask about what Canadians really think about climate change. Okay, so this is the joy of speaking in another country. You can't make any assumptions. And because I know Canada's got some things on the ball, this is a summary from 2022. That summary, which I've got in my references at the end, is a really interesting read, and they focus in one section on Quebec because they were ahead of the ballgame, apparently, in terms of thinking about climate change. Now, those of you who are my Canadian colleagues, I don't know enough to know if that's true, but they asked Quebecers, what could you describe these? Could you easily explain these concepts to another person? So I just went to look at it and say, could I do that? And I don't think there's anything that's really difficult there, but if you can't, hey, now you've got all work assignment. Okay. The other thing that we have experienced is those of us who have been scientists through the pandemic and have been in climate change communication know that there is often a distrust of science. So I was expecting that in this poll, it would show a distrust of science. But this showed that for most Canadians, scientists are by far the most trusted source of information. So for the scientists out there, I want to say use that power, that people do want to hear your voice. And I want to say that it's possible that Americans don't have quite that same pitch, but don't underestimate. However, this is also from that same poll, and they were trying in that poll of Canadians to get people to say, well, if I was to look at another country and say, why don't we do some of what they are doing? Who would I look at? And overwhelmingly, Canadians said, not the U.S. The U.S. is doing a terrible job at climate and any climate work. But this was actually what happened in the 2010 to 2019 decade, where the red ones are the ones that greenhouse gas emissions actually went up, and all the green ones are, the green is declining. So remarkably, the U.S. does have a few things going on, and did pull down greenhouse gases in that time period. And Canada, my dear friends, unfortunately, that didn't happen for you. But we can all feel really good in comparison to Turkey, which went up 27%. So I'm really not judging. I'm just okay. So communications experts stress several approaches when they're talking about climate. They talk about having repeated conversations. So one of the things that comes up in polls is that most people, especially in polls of Americans, don't have regular conversations about climate. It can be in the news all the time, but they're not talking about it in their homes. They're not talking about it in church. They're not talking about it at the workplace. The second is the use of narratives. Having a story about a person who's experiencing a climate effect is much more powerful. Another has to do with talking about shared values. So this is very well done by the Evangelical Environmental Network. They talk about climate change as a pro-life issue because of its effect on human health, especially on respiratory distress. And they, so if that's a value that's shared, that's very effective. But many scientists will tell you, you can say all the facts, you can say them over and over and over and over, and that is not what's compelling. Also, though, communications experts say to listen first. So, a lot of people have written about the theology of why we should care about the environment, and they have written about why we should care for our neighbor. That comes up in the document that I authored, but I want to focus on two things that in private conversations I have run into as things people don't know and were are a sticking point that I'm starting to focus on it in my own communication. So this is actually not a done thought. This is an invitation to all of you to tell me what you think people are struggling to know. But so let me just ask you if you know some words. One is, do you know what the Anthropocene is? Okay. Do you know what planetary boundaries are? Pure. Do you know what the Great Acceleration is? Even fewer. Okay, well, we're going to walk on from there. Would you be able to talk about what was meant by the term climate justice? Okay, Bonnie. Okay. So, this came up on the tour that I was on yesterday, the field trip. The Anthropocene is a term that is proposed for a new geological epoch, meaning the epoch we're in that is dominated by humans. And one idea that I have found very helpful in talking about climate change is to link it to what makes this time unique. Not just in human history, in planetary history. There has never been an individual species that has had the effect on the planet that humans have had. And I say that in the context of two ideas. And one is the Great Acceleration, which I've got a later slide to show. And this, which comes out of the Stockholm Resilience Center and is a circle that shows what we call planetary boundaries. So in 2009, a team of experts wrote a paper, Washington et al., in which they said, we've done the following. We tried to identify huge processes on Earth that we affect, humans affect, and that have to work right for humans to live. Then we attempted to assess how much we can safely modify them before humans can't live in them. And then we attempted to assess, estimate how much we have changed them already. So the center is the safe operating space. But as you go out from that, when you reach into the yellowish and then into the orange and red, you have passed out of the safe space. So it doesn't mean we are going to die tomorrow. It does mean we actually have to walk some things back. We have to go not back to another time period, but back to not messing with this one thing as much. And I want you to see a couple of things here. One is biosphere integrity, which includes loss of genetic material and habitats and ecosystems and everything. Novel entities, which was just like very recently identified as we have gone over that, refers to plastics and chemistry, everything that did not exist in the world that humans have come up with and put out into the world, and plastic in the ocean would be under that. Biogeochemical flows refers to things like the nitrogen cycle, and I want you to see that phosphorus and nitrogen are well outside. We're well into the danger zone. So just in case it didn't occur to you that there are things that we're more out of whack with than climate, there are. And I want to spin that into a positive and say many of the solutions that we have for climate change solve these other problems as well. Or they could if we're smart. So that's one thing I want you to know. Now, I want you to just get a sense of the scale of this, because one of the things that I find when I talk to people is that they just don't know the scale of human endeavor. In 1900, there were 1.6 billion people on Earth, up from 1 billion in 1804. Today, there's 8 billion, up from 7 billion in 2011. That's, we had a century where we went up 0.6 billion. We had a century where we went like 6 billion, 6 plus. So, honestly, can you see that acceleration? Now, I'm going to ask one question, but I've got to hurry on here. If you were to take the biomass of all terrestrial mammals, what percent of that mass that you weighed would be wild animals, not human or domestic? I want you to come up with a number in your head, okay? The number is 4%. 4% of terrestrial mammal biomass is wild. All the rest of it is human bodies and the bodies of domesticated mammals. Okay, when you hear a statistic like that, that is so shocking that I found when I'm communicating, if you can use just one or two statistics, and they're the right ones, somebody will say, oh, I wasn't quite getting that. Now, for those of you who don't know, this is the Great Acceleration Graphs. This was coined when researchers put together, Stefan et al. Put together this set of Earth systems trends and socioeconomic trends and said, look at this. They're all rising very rapidly. I hope you can see that these trends from about 1955 have all gone way up, and that includes just a lot of different things. I'm going to skip about global tipping points. I don't want to scare us all, but I want to say some things that I personally have had to deal with. And one is people thinking that there's some giant worldwide scam perpetrated by scientists. And I just want to say, none of the richest 100 people in the world are scientists. I looked them all up. I quite a number of persons in the fossil fuel industry, professional scientists, are not famous for being wealthy. And there's some other things that people don't know about scientists. So one is that they don't know that they're volunteers. Now, just in case you didn't know, all the experts that do the National Academies of Science and the IPCC work are volunteers. And then I just want to end, I know I need to end here, just on this one last idea about climate justice, because in America, at least right now, there is a discussion about whether the term social justice is anti-biblical. And I'm not even going to talk about all of it, but I want to swing us back to this planetary boundaries and just say that we need to talk about justice differently. And this circle has the planetary boundaries on the inside, but it also has an inside space. That inside space is what promotes justice. That is, to get a safe and just space, everybody has to have access to resources. Everybody has to have a healthy environment. We have to live within these boundaries, but they can't be unfairly divided. And I'm actually going to end on that. And thank you.
Yes, in the very back.
I was wondering if we should be bringing in the issue of CO2 and cognitive abilities into this sphere. And there's some research about CO2 when it gets up to around 600 or above ppm, then start losing some cognitive abilities.
Question about the impact of CO2 levels on cognitive abilities as part of this picture.
Well, I can think of a couple of ways that you might want to incorporate that, but my first thought is just, if we're at 600, many things have gone awry long before that. However, locally, we could get to very high, very local levels of CO2 as a result of trying to sequester CO2 down in the seabed and having that not work. And there have been cases where not CO2, but methane has come up in huge balls and whole villages of people have died. I think in a warming world that is predicted to happen more often. And if any of our technology that was used to sequester CO2 failed, that would also happen.
It sounds like you've had a lot of conversations with people. And I'd just like to, I had a recent one that was very frustrating. And I just wanted to ask you, how do you personally resist using facts when you're
so, how can you avoid using facts and having conversations with climate skeptics?
Well, let me just be careful. I don't mean don't use facts. But I do mean, you could use a lot of them that wouldn't actually hit home. And so when I, even though it's not about climate, when I say that about 4% wild animals, people realize that their sense of the world is wildly off. And because I am an ecologist, I know more about those kinds of things, so I'll say something about what percent of the largest fish in the ocean still exist? 10%. That is collapsing food chains that are affecting your life. That coexists with and it are risk multipliers with climate change. So I do use some facts. However, I have had to come to the place where
I realize that in any encounter, it's not ever about winning, and I may not persuade people. It always has to be about loving the person first. And that is because, in my experience, I haven't ever met somebody who changed their mind because they were mocked or scorned, or who truly engaged with something that they thought they were disrespecting. This is not everybody agrees with me on that. And, but I think there's people that will never change their minds. The young people that I encounter desperately want to talk about climate change. They want tools to talk to their parents. And they are terrified of not knowing what to do. So I'm sort of switched from persuasion, this is a problem, to empowerment and fighting climate despair as my goals and empowering young people.
So having the power of the microphone, I'm hoping I can jump in with a question of my own. Having written the two versions of this Loving the Least of These booklet that you did for the NAE, kind of gives you a unique vantage point. And you talked about some of the caution you need to feel earlier on. Were there differences in response for the target audience of that booklet between the two versions? And were there any encouraging signs that you saw in that?
That's hard to answer, because when in the first version did not get as much movement as we had hoped right off the bat. But it did, over time, gather steam. So there's a lot of colleges that use it in courses. And there's people that are trying to communicate with other people that will pass along this as something that was helpful to them. I think the most difficult part for us in the second was, in the first, we basically didn't make any policy suggestions. Because, you know, what should we do? Pray. Think better about this. Look at it. But if you're trying to empower, make change, you have to have some things to say, right? And that part remains a very difficult part in conversation. But people, you know, were asking, in fact, the BEN and World Relief partnered with us on the second edition because they wanted a new edition out. So they're using it as well.
Thank you. Yes, over here.
I'm wondering if you can say a bit more about these two questions on the slide. The upper one sounds like it's for Canadians, and the lower one sounds like it's for Americans. Since the default assumption in Canada is usually government is involved in everything, and in America, government shouldn't be involved in anything. I'm exaggerating, of course, but I don't quite understand the thrust of the question.
I am so brilliant that I put that up there. No, I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. So this was actually in sort of talking back to people using the term social justice to mean heavy-handed government redistribution of wealth and opposing it to individual deeds of kindness. And I am firmly in the camp that we are past individual deeds of kindness solving this, that it has to involve large-scale collaborations and agreements. So I think asking the question, can we achieve justice without involving governments? I know people spark a no. We don't in other places. That's why we have courts and laws, right? And could we make a theological case that government should be involved? And I'm throwing that out to my theologian friends. I think yes, but I also think, you know, there's a group of people who are sort of sitting back and saying, Well, it's not biblical because it involves, you know, there's no theological case of Jesus didn't come to set up a government or whatever.
We're at time. Thank you all for being part of the session.